this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And starting on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the cover story headline, Hat in the Cloud. Red Hat's Jim Whitehurst is betting big on storage technology, and the stakes are high for Raleigh. And that's the front page. The cover story actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Red Stacked. For Raleigh's largest public company, future growth hangs in the cloud. And this article is written by Lauren Onosorge. Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst doesn't look like your stereotypical gambler. Instead of slot machines, he's surrounded by the Raleigh skyline. Instead of card sharks, he's mingling with coders. In his typical uniform, a white button-up shirt and blue jeans, he sits at a desk in an office atop Red Hat Tower, the 19-story downtown nucleus of what some call the future of information technology infrastructure, making a high-stakes bet, one that doesn't just impact the coders in the cubicles, but all of Raleigh. Because if Red Hat sneezes, the ripples could give the city's tech culture the economic equivalent of a summer cold. If he's correct, however, those ripples could crown Raleigh as Cloud Capital USA. He's betting on cloud computing, what's been called the future of IT. You use it every day when you check your email or when you listen to a song on your smartphone. The emails and songs all come from that intangible cloud, the place that stores billions and billions of data sets. Whitehurst, like many of his peers in the tech world, thinks this technology will further integrate itself, not just into people's daily lives, but into the IT strategy behind every business in the globe. But he's betting on specific architecture and a specific kind of collaboration within that intangible concept. The risks are high for the company with a $14 billion market cap, but so are the potential rewards. Red Hat, says Whitehurst, has the biggest open source cloud businesses, so big that if it were a standalone operation, it would be, quote, the second largest open source software company, unquote, second only to Red Hat itself. But in an industry where a couple of guys with a computer can easily develop the next big thing with relatively little capital, bulk isn't always an indicator of a winning bet. The technology. Generally, Red Hat's cloud business comes down to two open source projects, OpenShift and OpenStack. Both support cloud service, and both are complicated yet integral to Red Hat's cloud strategy. OpenShift is the software to OpenStack's hardware. OpenStack provides what's called infrastructure as a service, providing bootable virtual machines and storage. Examples of service providers based on OpenStack include HP Cloud and Rackspace Cloud. OpenShift is the product that provides platform as a service with the necessary parts to quickly deploy the technology used to build dynamic websites and web applications. OpenShift allows developers to create applications and quickly deploy them. Typically, an operation is built and handed to an IT department, a place with stacks of servers. Those professionals then have to implement the applications, a process that can take weeks. With OpenShift, you'd be able to deploy that virtually, Baird equity research analyst Steve Ashley explains. The developer would be able to hit send. It is an application technology. To further complicate things, it's what's called a container technology. Containers run on another Red Hat associated technology, Linux, and enclose a program in a software layer that then connects to the operating system. The benefit is that it can be moved very quickly from computer to computer. It is lightweight. As a result, you need less computer hardware, Ashley says, and portable, and it is ideal for hybrid environments as it can be deployed to both public and private clouds. If you're running a program on your private cloud, Ashley explains, and there's a surge in demand, with a hybrid system, you could spill over into a public cloud, such as Amazon Web Services. Whitehurst says hybrid is another way the company is hedging its bets. Regardless of whatever is ultimately adopted, be it a private or a public cloud, OpenShift works on both. The competition. As the number one code contributor to both OpenStack and OpenShift, Red Hat is helping define the future of those projects. When you're a company looking to buy those products, you certainly want a vendor that can influence and have some presence in those open source communities, Ashley says. But Red Hat isn't just betting on OpenShift and containers. It's also betting on a specific container, dubbed Docker. So far, it's paid off as both Red Hat and Docker have dominated the open source cloud conversation, but they're not the only two players. There are a lot of competing architectures, Ashley says. VMware, for example, turns software into a virtual machine, employing the technology in its platform, but it's impossible to see which cloud architecture will take the title. Other tech giants are making their own bets, and they, too, have big research and development wallets. HP and VMware are among Red Hat's big competitors in the space, even though both companies have actually partnered with some Red Hat technology. Both have also shifted some of their attention to Red Hat's sweet spot, OpenStack, contributing their own resources to the project. More established players talking about it more and supporting it just makes it a more credible solution, Whitehurst says, brushing off the competition. Ashley thinks the cloud bet will materialize in 2 years, meaning that in one way or the other, a victor could be named soon. And there are a lot of contenders. Cloud competitors also developing tools to implement private clouds include Citrix, Microsoft, Pivotal, and VMware. Public cloud providers such as Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and Rackspace are also competitors. The challenge. Whitehurst has to convince both his board and stockholders that the cloud bet will pay off, even as numbers show that, despite years of investment, the unit has yet to really make a profit for Red Hat. The company even blamed, quote, increased staffing costs to support our emerging cloud offerings, unquote, when the gross profit margin slipped in the last fiscal year. Convincing backers to keep the faith that an intangible concept with slow adoption rates will be Red Hat's next windfall requires persistence. Whitehurst says he's done it before. He points to the grief he got from investors 6 years ago when investing a lot of money in another technology line dubbed JBoss. Now that is growing extremely fast, but it took a lot of time, he says. Overnight successes take 7 or 8 years, so if we wait until our regular products are slowing down and then invest in new stuff, there's going to be a long gap. And Whitehurst isn't willing to let that happen. As part of Red Hat's application development and emerging technology business, cloud is a big chunk of the company's research and development budget, $97 million in total during the first quarter of this year, although the company doesn't break down specifics. In addition to cloud offerings, the business unit includes Red Hat, JBoss Middleware, and Red Hat Storage Technologies. For the full fiscal year 2015, that unit as a whole represented just 13.2% of total revenue, having grown from 10.8% in 2014 and 9.1% in 2013. Ashley calls OpenShift and OpenStack potential kickers to Red Hat's story. That's because while Red Hat's traditional open source business continues to make up the majority of revenue dollars, Whitehurst's crystal ball tells him that the tide is turning. The open source concept has coders from around the world collaborating with Red Hat to ensure that its version will be what customers want when adoption does eventually take off. The market is maturing, says Ashley, adding that Red Hat is definitely a leader in the space right now. Red Hat simply has more experience and expertise developing an OpenStack than these other companies, and it is moving faster. The strategy. In the meantime, Red Hat's other business units are bulking up too. It's a retain and reload strategy of maintaining and fine-tuning the traditional business while attacking the cloud vertical and banking on a cloud future. Recently, the company announced a blockbuster partnership with Samsung, one that some say could rival a similar relationship between IBM and Apple and influence future smart devices. The collaboration is intended to deliver the next generation of mobile enterprise applications and solutions and could further bulk up Red Hat's other business units. And the addition of a top CFO Frank Calderoni, who comes to Red Hat after years of running the finance operation for networking giant Cisco, enhances Red Hat's overall strategy. If you ask Whitehurst, cloud computing is still the most exciting thing on the horizon, but other tech mammoths like HP and VMware are betting against him. While the unit that incorporates its cloud technology business was only 5% of its revenue in the past quarter, VMware has been zeroing in on its own brand of cloud architecture, as has HP. Though neither of them has the open source cloud girth Red Hat has, they do have cash, with $15.1 billion and $1.9 billion in cash respectively. HP and VMware have resources to throw at the cloud should inspiration strike. And with new players emerging all the time, it's hard to say who could round out the cloud list in 5 years. I think you'll see it really start to ramp up as we go through this year, Whitehurst predicts. By 2018, Red Hat is facing an addressable market of more than $60 billion, he says. These are massive multi-billion dollar markets for us to go after, he reiterates. The stakeholders. Vendors, big and small, are backing Red Hat's gamble. Some of those stakeholders are in the triangle, such as 10-person open-source startup Transcirrus, which is led by NetApp veteran Ingemar Lanevi. It's pushing an OpenStack device and just partnered with Red Hat on an enterprise version, a move that opens it up to a huge new customer base, Lanevi says. Even Amazon, also a competitor, has partnered with Red Hat on technology. And the list of certified cloud providers include Fujitsu, Google, IBM, and Canon. The biggest stakeholder, however, could be the city of Raleigh. With Red Hat's 1,200 employees milling about, and new employees receiving their honorary hats all the time, so many that Whitehurst says the firm is on track to outgrow the tower in 2 years, the company's headquarters has become the pulse of downtown Raleigh's tech culture. Employees eat at Buku downstairs or grab a beer at Busy Bee. They live at the new luxury apartment and condo complexes rising into the skyline. And perhaps more importantly to the vitality of downtown Raleigh, the tech workforce they've helped create is starting to cause a feeding frenzy, with other tech companies expanding into Raleigh to grab a bite of talent. Since Whitehurst's announcement 3 years ago of Red Hat's downtown move, Citrix, Ipreo, and EvaluServe are some of the companies to move downtown, bringing their own headcounts and buzz. And their execs say that it's partly to be part of what Red Hat is creating, a technology mecca. When it comes to innovation, density is absolutely critical, says Jesse Lipson, local site lead at Citrix. He cites studies that show that for every doubling of population density, innovation increases by 15%. Which makes sense because of all the cross-pollination of information that starts to happen when companies are located close to each other, he says. He points to co-working spaces such as HQ Raleigh and O2 Fitness, founder Michael Olander's new tech entrepreneurship space downtown, as other pieces in that density chain. As for Whitehurst, he says he takes no credit for the tech hub starting to ripple downtown, although he does admit it's what he hoped would happen when he announced the move. We try to be a catalyst in the community, he says. Should Red Hat's bets pay off, it will keep growing, driving that culture, solidifying Raleigh's new reputation as a regional tech hub, if those bets pay off. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The first headline, Cinebistro names GM exec chef. The new Cinebistro that will be opening in Cary in the fall has hired two veterans of the high-end restaurant industry to begin hiring soon for its anticipated staff of 60 people. Jim Russo, a former managing partner with Bravo Brio Restaurant Group, who helped open and manage the Brio Tuscan Grill at Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh, has been hired as general manager of the Cinebistro at Waverly Place. Jason Bianco, a former executive chef at the Palm Restaurants in Dallas and Orlando, and Morton Steakhouse in Coral Gables, Florida, has been named executive chef. Bianco is currently executive chef of the Cinebistro location in Wesley Chapel, Florida, near Tampa. Cinebistro, a concept owned by Cobb Theaters, shows first-run movies and independent films in a theater setting with high-back leather chairs, plus a full-service bar and restaurant open to the public that also offers food and drink services inside the theaters. Cobb has so far opened 7 Cinebistro locations across the country. Both Jim and Jason have a passion for creating memorable meals and experiences, says Fred Myers, vice president of Cinebistro. We have assembled a great team in Cary and look forward to introducing Cinebistro to the Triangle area. The 35,000-square-foot Cinebistro at Waverly Place is expected to open in August. Zach Williams to speak at September Gala at Angus Barn. Zach Williams, son of the late actor and comedian Robin Williams, will be coming to Raleigh in September to speak at the annual gala of the Foundation of Hope for Research and Treatment of Mental Illness. The Evening of Hope will be at the Angus Barn Pavilion on September 24 and will include a 5-course dinner prepared by Chef Walter Royal, wine pairings, and live and silent auctions. Zach Williams has been touring the country speaking to mental illness foundations and associations about growing up with his father, who took his life last August. The Foundation of Hope recognizes that the stigma associated with mental illness often makes circumstances even more difficult for those living with often devastating conditions, according to its website. Lewis Black enjoys crashing at his Chapel Hill pad. Esquire magazine recently asked actor-comedian Lewis Black during an interview, "What are the things that make you most happy?" Black answered, "My friends, being able to spend time in my home in New York and in an apartment that I have in Chapel Hill. Just getting that time, which is rare. And sadly, wine makes me happy. Wine and golf." Black has a voice role in the new Pixar film Inside Out, the tale of a girl named Riley, and 5 emotions that control her personality. Joy, sadness, fear, disgust, and anger. Black plays anger. Windsor Circle takes all at dodgeball tourney. Staff from Durham-based Windsor Circle recently won the American Tobacco Campus dodgeball tournament held June 19 at the Durham YMCA. "If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball," says Matt Williamson, CEO of Windsor Circle. "And our team is the best bunch of wrench dodgers around." And finally, in a section called The Hype, Triangle Cities make headlines in recent national rankings. Number 6, Raleigh is 6th among 18 new hubs for economic growth, according to the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Number 14, Raleigh is 14th best city for recession rebound, according to Glassdoor. Number 22, Raleigh is 22nd best city for bang for the buck, according to Forbes magazine. And playful cities. Raleigh, Durham, Garner, and Creedmoor were named among the most playful cities 2015 for offering youth access to active play. And that's according to Kaboom and Humana Foundation. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Grand Opening, Brand New Digs Open at MetLife and Charter Square. MetLife Chairman and CEO Steve Kandarian and members of the New York Insurance Firm's Board of Directors were on hand June 22 to open the company's new $125 million global technology campus on Weston Parkway in Cary. MetLife has about 1,000 employees or technologists in Cary working out of 2 7-story 213,500 square foot office buildings that the company is leasing from Highwoods Properties. "It's a great day for MetLife and a great day for North Carolina," Kandarian told the crowd gathered under a tent on the courtyard overlooking Lake Crabtree on Weston Parkway. Kandarian also announced that the company has reached its jobs creation goals to qualify for its state and local incentives package 6 months ahead of schedule. In downtown Raleigh, real estate developer Andy Andrews and his investment partners at Prudential Real Estate Investors also celebrated on June 18 the completion of the 11-story, $63 million Charter Square office building on Fayetteville Street. To date, Charter Square is 56% leased, and the development team is seeking LEED Platinum certification for the building project, the highest level of certification for energy efficiency. Wilmington's Mayfair Town Center sells for $192 million. CBL & Associates Properties, known also as the co-owner of Triangle Town Center Mall in North Raleigh, has taken on another big position in the state with its $192 million purchase of the Mayfair Town Center and Community Center in Wilmington on June 18. Chattanooga, Tennessee-based CBL acquired the property through an all-cash deal with the developers of Mayfair, Greenville-based Brody Company Incorporated, and Wilmington-based Zimmer Development Company. Mayfair Town Center, located on Military Cutoff Road near the intersection with Eastwood Road, is a 610,000-square-foot open-air shopping center anchored by a Belk department store and a 16-screen Regal cinema with an IMAX theater. The adjacent Mayfair Community Center is a 210,000-square-foot center anchored by a Harris Teeter grocery store, Dick's Sporting Goods, and Marshall's. Triangle grocery stores ranked by market share. Walmart and Food Lion kept their number one and number two spots atop the Triangle area grocery market in 2014, but the introduction of several new brands seeking out locations in the region are already threatening a shift in power. Lidl, a German-based grocer that's a direct rival to Aldi, has committed to opening 35 stores in North Carolina, and several other grocer brands that would be new to the Triangle, like Sprouts Farmers Market, Wegmans, Target Express, and City Target, have shown interest in opening new locations in the Triangle, says Charlie Coyne, Director of Retail Services at CBRE Raleigh. H Mart Asian Grocery to open first North Carolina store in Cary. New Jersey-based grocery chain H Mart, a grocer that specializes in Korean and other Asian foods, has signed a deal to open its first store in North Carolina at the Cornerstone Village Shopping Center on High House Road in Cary. H Mart will be moving into the former Lowe's Foods anchor space that Lowe's had vacated in 2013. The new store for H Mart should be open by mid-2016. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBrun. The main article headline, Triangle Pharma to pay $6 million to settle case. Inspire Pharmaceuticals, a company with a 20-year history in the Triangle, agreed to pay $6 million to settle a federal civil fraud claim that it marketed an eye treatment for uses that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration had not approved, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. The office said in a release that Inspire, quote, misleadingly focused on purported anti-inflammatory properties of azacite that were unsupported by substantial evidence or substantial clinical experience in order to cause doctors to prescribe azacite for uses not covered by federal health care programs, which resulted in federal health care programs paying millions of dollars in false claims. Inspire has a long history in the Triangle and is generally considered one of the success stories by those in the area's pharmaceutical industry. The time of the fraudulent marketing came before it operated as a subsidiary of Merck & Company. Inspire, based in Durham at the time, went public in 2000 and was acquired by Merck in 2011. The federal allegations against Inspire said it improperly marketed an eye drop called Azocyte from 2008 through 2011. Inspire was founded by Christy Schaefer, who was CEO until 2010, when Adrian Adams, who already had a long pharmaceutical career in Philadelphia, took over. Schaefer is now a venture partner with Hatteras Venture Partners, the life sciences investment group in Durham. Reached by email, Schaefer said, "I was there until February 2010, and then Adrian Adams became CEO. The letter sent to Inspire appeared to have occurred in April of 2011. I was not involved with this settlement process, thus I really cannot comment." Reached by phone, Adams said the marketing practices were inherited and that changes were made shortly after his arrival. "We made changes, etc., because we felt that we needed to make some changes. We are very proud of the changes we made," he said. "Those were aspects of promotion and claims, etc., that we inherited, and we spent time putting all that right." In 2013, Acorn Incorporated, a niche generic pharmaceutical company based in Lake Forest, Illinois, acquired various eye treatments from Merck, including Inspire's Azocyte, for $53 million in cash. Adams recently became CEO of Posen, which will change its name to Aralez Pharmaceuticals after it completes an acquisition. The federal complaint. In 2007, the FDA approved Azocyte only for the treatment of conjunctivitis, a bacterial infection of the eye more commonly known as pink eye. However, Inspire sought to generate more revenue by aggressively marketing the drug for the non-FDA approved treatment of blepharitis, a different eye condition involving inflammation of the eyelids, according to a statement from Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, and Scott J. Lampert, Special Agent in Charge of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Inspector General's New York Region. According to federal investigators, Inspire in 2008 began a promotional effort to encourage physicians to prescribe Azocyte to treat blepharitis, even though the FDA had not approved Azocyte to treat blepharitis. The complaint adds that after receiving FDA approval for Azocyte, Inspire based its advertising on treating children for pink eye by prominently displaying a child in its advertisements and emphasizing the ease of administering Azocyte with only 9 drops. Inspire changed its marketing strategy by highlighting the purported anti-inflammatory characteristics of Azocyte, not including a child in its advertisements, and substantially reducing its marketing toward pediatricians and primary care physicians, while instead targeting doctors likely to treat blepharitis, according to the complaint. In 2011, the FDA sent a letter to Inspire informing the company that its then-prominent advertisement improperly suggested that Azocyte had anti-inflammatory effects, even though this had not been demonstrated by substantial evidence. FDA told Inspire that its advertisement was, quote, "false or misleading because it broadens the indication, makes unsubstantiated claims, and omits and minimizes important risks associated with the use of Azocyte," unquote. As part of the settlement, Inspire admitted wrongdoing, according to the statement of the federal regulators. The case was initially brought by a whistleblower under the False Claims Act. And in a section called Big Numbers, $45 million, what Durham-based BioCryst Pharmaceuticals could make, in addition to royalties, in a licensing deal for its flu treatment, Rapivap. BioCryst reached a deal with CSL Limited, based in Australia, in which CSL will sell the drug and BioCryst will share in the profits. The royalty payments range from a rate in the mid-teens to low 40s on net sales. BioCryst gets $33.7 million upfront and up to $12 million more depending on reaching regulatory milestones for Rapivap, an injectable influenza treatment. $50 million. raised by Research Triangle Park's TransEnterix. While the company waits for a ruling on its next-generation surgical robot, it went to the public markets to raise enough money to launch a sales effort. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is in the process of considering TransEnterix SurgiBot system surgical tool, a medical device that can be used by surgeons. If the FDA approves the robot, TransEnterix will look to sell them in hospitals across the country. The additional money will help launch that sales effort. And $125 million, what Durham drug developer Chimerix could spend on research and development this year. And now we move to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, Babies Are Welcome, the latest trend in co-working. For Tiffany Fry, entrepreneurship and motherhood have combined into a unique startup, one that could change how people think about co-working in Durham. Dubbed Nido, her co-working space, which opened in June on Broad Street, doubles as a daycare and is intended for female freelancers and entrepreneurs who have their own double lives as moms. Fry started the initiative to solve her own problem. When her daughter was 3 months old, she was offered an editorial job that would let her work from home. I thought, obviously, there's a co-working space that offers childcare in the Triangle somewhere, she says, but she thought wrong. I remember it was one of those moments where I thought, I'm going to do that. It needs to exist. But Fry, a new mom, didn't exactly have startup capital laying around, so she transformed her three-bedroom Durham home into the prototype for four families last fall, complete with a chalkboard, painted, and child-proofed deck. Last winter, she teamed up with another mom and member, Liz Tyroler, and together they scored more than $20,000 in loans from family members, setting out to secure a more permanent solution, a commercial space in downtown Durham. The new space on Broad Street is more than 2,000 square feet, double what she had at home, and the new space also houses an experienced Montessori-style teacher, she says. The program is able to educate children from 6 weeks to 6 years old, and in its first week, 12 families are already involved. Everyone comes on a part-time basis, she says. Fry, who quit her J&J editorial job in March, is now full-time manager. Rates start at $350 for 2 half-days per week for the month, and go up from there. For just half days on Saturdays, it's $160 per month. It's a more expensive option than a co-working membership at HQ Raleigh, which starts at $125 per month, and American Underground, which starts at $199, but it's in the tailored education program for kids that Fry sees the real value. And membership also includes access to programs such as a speed dating event that pairs moms up with other moms, and an upcoming freelance lecture. Fry, who was assisted by the Durham chapter of National Mentoring Effort, SCORE, says the space could accommodate 50 to 55 families part-time, or 20 adults and 16 children at one time, and men are welcome. They're currently a minority, but there are some male members, she says. Gardner lures big-name Triangle investors. A Cary-based investment startup spearheaded by angel investor David Gardner has closed on the bulk of a $12 million investment round and says that's thanks to more than 80 investors, including Channel Advisor founder Scott Wingo and Authentech founder Scott Moody. Gardner says the fund, dubbed Co-Founders Capital Fund 1, will focus on early-stage entrepreneurs in the business-to-business software space in the Triangle. Primarily, it's because the cash goes a lot farther. A couple of hundred grand writes a lot of software these days, he says. Proto Labs to expand, bring 170 new jobs to Cary. Proto Labs, a Minnesota parts manufacturer that bought Cary's Fine Line Prototyping in 2014, is doubling down on Cary. The company is bringing a $25 million investment and 170 new jobs to the Cary operation. Since the acquisition, we've increased the capacity, which has allowed the business to grow, explains John Way, CFO of Proto Labs, pointing to an 80% growth in the unit for the first quarter as compared to the same time period last year. With Fineline, Proto Labs acquired additive manufacturing capabilities, aka 3D printing, and that unit has become the fastest growing service line in the business, Way says. Currently, the company has 106 people in Cary. Way says a new building has been located, but isn't able to release any details yet, other than that it's in town limits. And in the She Said It section, the quote is, "It shouldn't be a political football." And that quote is from Ann Goodnight, Director of Community Relations for analytics giant SAS, speaking out about the need for more investment in education, specifically STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Transportation page, written by Jeff Jeffrey. The first headline, Phoenix, Washington, D.C., top list of delayed routes out of RDU. If you're flying to Phoenix or Washington, D.C. out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport, you might want to brace yourself for delays. Flights between RDU and Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport, PHX, and Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, DCA, are virtually tied when it comes to the number of delayed flights, according to data collected by the U.S. Bureau of Transportation Statistics. Both routes saw just 6 out of 10 flights leave on time in 2014. Overall, roughly 8 out of 10 flights left RDU on time last year, putting the airport slightly ahead of the national average. The route with the highest on-time percentage was the one between RDU and Salt Lake City International Airport, SLC, which saw flights leave on time roughly 92% of the time in 2014. However, Delta Airlines stopped offering a flight between RDU and SLC in November. BTS considers a flight delayed when its actual departure time is later than 15 minutes or more than its scheduled departure time. RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin says the airport has little to do with ensuring flights leave on time. That responsibility falls to the airline, she says. During the summer months, we tend to see more delays to our northeast flights because of thunderstorms, Hamlin says. BTS reports that the primary reason for flight delays at RDU are because of an air carrier delay, which is a delay that is due to circumstances within the airline's control. The Bureau cites maintenance or crew problems, aircraft cleaning, baggage loading, and fueling as examples. Other reasons for flight delays include aircraft arriving late, weather, security delays, and delays caused by the national aviation system. Shopping center owner wins $1.2 million lawsuit versus NCDOT. The North Carolina Attorney General's office has not ruled out an appeal in a case that saw a Wilmington jury award a $1.2 million verdict to a local property owner who claimed a North Carolina Department of Transportation project destroyed access to half the location's parking lot. Carmine LLC owns a portion of the North 17 Plaza shopping center that faces Market Street in Wilmington. Carmine sued NCDOT after a project to widen Carr Avenue and Market Street allegedly caused the shopping center to lose half of a driveway onto Market Street and 50 parking spaces through 5 years of reconstruction. The parking lot had 99 parking spots prior to the project. According to the suit, NCDOT offered a settlement of $263,007, but a jury awarded Carmine $1.2 million plus interest based on evidence presented by an appraiser hired by Carmine's attorneys. Noelle Talley, a spokeswoman for the AG's office, says, Attorneys with our office are reviewing the verdict and consulting with their client, DOT. But she noted the time period to file an appeal has not expired. A spokesman for NCDOT declined to comment. George Autry, an attorney at Cranfill, Sumner, and Herzog in Raleigh, says he hopes the verdict forces NCDOT to rethink how it approaches its effort to enforce eminent domain claims to property. In eminent domain cases, no one is right and no one is wrong, Autry says, but there is a right way and a wrong way to go about it. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, written by Todd Cohen. And first, we have Todd Cohen's column. Todd Cohen also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, After Foster Care, Teens Need Support. Adulthood can be tough for young people after they leave foster care. Most children and teens enter foster care as a result of abuse or neglect by their biological families. They often are moved from one foster family to another, and often are disappointed by the adults in their lives and not prepared to live on their own. That kind of childhood can take its toll. More than 1 in 5 of the 20,000 young people in the U.S. who age out of foster care each year at age 18 will become homeless, and only 58% will graduate from high school by age 19. Working to prepare foster kids in Wake County for adulthood is the Hope Center at Pullen. Formed in 2009, the nonprofit this year is serving more than 100 teens ages 13 to 24, up from only 12 young people it served 3 years ago. Typically referred by Wake County Child Protective Services or by homeless shelters, those young people work with the Hope Center caseworkers and partner agencies to develop an individual plan that includes goals in the areas of housing, education, employment, financial management, physical and mental health, and creating a support network. The idea is to serve as a one-stop shop that will provide young people aging out of foster care with a map they can use and the resources and support they will need to make a seamless transition to living on their own as adults. Formed in 2009, the Hope Center partners with 7 agencies that provide a broad range of support to it, the young people it serves, and its volunteer mentors who work with those young people. Young people have the option of working not only with volunteer mentors, but also with volunteer tutors. Volunteers also provide clients of the Hope Center with transportation to paid positions the agency helps arrange for them at local nonprofits. We're trying to build a support system, someone positive in their life, says Stacy Bluth, executive director at the Hope Center. In Wake County, where roughly 300 young people, ages 13 to 18, are in foster care, 30 to 40 age out of it each year. The Hope Center generates funds from United Way of the Greater Triangle, the City of Raleigh, Wake County, individual donors, foundations, and special events. And with a grant of $123,000 from United Way, the Hope Center is teaming with 6 other agencies to provide support for people who have aged out of foster care and now are parents. Children of parents who were in foster care are 5 times as likely than other parents to end up in foster care themselves. The Hope Center also is launching a strategic planning effort to map its own future and possibly create a model for other communities. We are committed to serving as many young people in Wake County who need us, Bluth says, and developing a model of programs and services that meet all their needs. And in nonprofit news, Jimmy V's raises $125,000 for cancer. In the first 18 months, Jimmy V's Osteria and Bar in Raleigh has raised more than $125,000 for cancer research. The restaurant donates 2.5% of its year-round revenue to the V Foundation, named for former NC State basketball coach Jim Valvano. Centerline Digital builds Habitat Home. 4 Centerline Digital employees recently spent workdays building a home with Habitat for Humanity of Wake County, The company encourages employees to volunteer during the workday and has aimed to collectively give more than 100 days of service locally. I wanted to shake things up a bit and step outside of my comfort zone. I thought Habitat was an ideal way to do that with the comfort of supportive coworkers, said Senior Project Manager Megan Riley. 22,000 Happy Meals donated for kids. In the Triangle, one out of every four children qualifies as food insecure, a problem compounded in the summer. Owners, operators of the 123 McDonald's restaurants in the Triangle pledged to provide a free Happy Meal for each Happy Meal sold on Mondays in May. That totaled 22,000 Happy Meals, and McDonald's handed over that many vouchers to the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. The business profile in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal focuses on Logan's Garden Shop. The headline, Making Gardens Grow for 50 Years. Logan's one-stop garden shop thrives despite big box competition. And this article is written by Jeff Jeffrey. For Leslie Logan Brown and her younger brother, Joshua Logan, taking over the family business comes with a lot of responsibility. They mark the third generation of Logans to operate Logan's one-stop garden shop, which was founded in Raleigh 50 years ago this month. Over the decades, the nursery and garden center have become a fixture of the downtown scene. But despite facing stiff competition and a changing customer base, Brown says the store is better positioned than it has ever been and is looking to grow. The responsibility of carrying the Logan name means we have to continue to run the business with the same integrity as my father and grandfather, Brown says. That's who we are. Robert Logan Sr. opened Logan Trading Company in 1965 at the State Farmers Market. The original aim of the company was to sell worms out of vending machines to fishermen. That idea quickly transformed into a railroad salvage business, which only later became a plant supply store. When Robert Logan Sr. died in 1984, his son Robert Jr. took over the store with his wife Julie. This year is the first in which Brown and Joshua Logan are running the shop. The Raleigh natives grew up in the store and worked summers there in high school and college. However, Leslie and Joshua both tried their hands at different careers before feeling drawn back to the family business. Their parents still work in the store for a few hours each week, but the day-to-day decisions are now up to the younger generation. Brown says she tends to be more business-oriented, while her brother brings a visionary perspective to the store. We really partner well and are able to appreciate each other's strengths and lean on each other, Brown says. That's not always the case with family-owned businesses. Sticking to the family's roots is central to Logan's ability to stay relevant, she says. Nearly every big box store offers a garden section, often with prices that are lower than those at Logan's. But Brown says Logan's customers keep coming back because of the service they receive. By being locally owned, Brown says the store's employees are able to get to know their customers and help them find plants that fit their individual needs. The people who come here aren't just customers to us, Brown says. We know what's going on in their lives, who's sick and whose kids are starting school. We consider ourselves part of the community. It must be paying off. Logan's annual revenue now exceeds $5.5 million, which Brown says is an all-time high. The increased revenue has given the store some options. Brown says Logan's will remain in the former train station off of P Street it has occupied since 1991, but the store is considering adding more pop-up locations during the summer months. Brown says temporary locations in North Hills and elsewhere have been successful in driving sales and in marketing the Logan's name. The store also hasn't ruled out opening a second permanent location. Given the nature of the business, Logan's revenues are strongly seasonal in nature. The store employs about 30 full-time employees, but in the spring, when 50% of sales are made, Logan's adds an additional 35 part-time employees. These days, the store is looking for ways to serve the increased foot traffic Logan's has seen in recent years. Driven by the host of new apartment buildings opening in downtown Raleigh. That's forced Logan's to rethink the products it offers, adding more plants that do well in an apartment setting. Gardening offers people so many benefits, whether it's being able to grow your own produce or herbs or just as a stress reliever, Brown says. We feel people should be able to reap those benefits, even if they're living in a high-rise. Logan's has also ramped up its charitable programs. The company is heavily involved in Raleigh's Plant a Row program, which gathers produce grown by local gardeners and distributes it to organizations that feed the hungry. That's something we got from our dad, Brown says. We want to run Logan's with the idea that it's about serving something bigger than yourself. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And first, there's a guest column concerning nonprofits written by David Heinen, Vice President for Public Policy and Advocacy for North Carolina Center for Nonprofits in Raleigh. The headline, Tax Changes for North Carolina Nonprofits Present Challenges. In recent years, North Carolinians have increasingly turned to charitable nonprofits to help meet basic needs like childcare, healthcare, affordable housing, healthy food, and job training. Unfortunately, many of the nonprofits that provide these essential services are themselves struggling to survive. According to the Nonprofit Finance Fund's recent 2015 State of the Sector survey, 78% of North Carolina nonprofits experienced an increase in demand for services last year, and 60% were unable to meet this demand. Part of this strain on the nonprofit sector is tied to characteristics that differentiate charitable nonprofits from for-profit businesses. To be tax-exempt as 501c3, organizations, nonprofits give up their three basic rights that are critical to the success of other businesses: profits, privacy, and politics. Unlike for-profit businesses, no one owns a nonprofit. While many nonprofits do make a profit, they are required by law to reinvest all of their earnings back into their charitable missions and the communities they serve, rather than distributing their profits to shareholders, directors, owners, or investors. The nonprofit sector has a culture of transparency. Legally, tax-exempt nonprofits are required to make their annual tax information returns and other government filings available to the public. Consequently, information about their programs, revenues and expenses, compensation of key employees, and the identity of directors and officers is all a matter of public record. Lastly, federal tax law rightly prohibits charitable nonprofits from engaging in partisan politics. While 501c3 nonprofits can lobby and educate elected officials on policy issues, they can lose their tax-exempt status if they contribute to or coordinate activities with political parties or candidates for office. At a time when corporate political spending is at a record high, charitable nonprofits don't have the luxury of using money to influence public policy. In exchange for giving up profits, privacy, and politics, charitable nonprofits have traditionally been exempt from paying most federal, state, and local taxes and have been allowed to receive tax-deductible contributions. As nonprofits' financial resources have struggled to keep up with the growing need for their services, charitable organizations must use their limited capacity efficiently and effectively. As a result, nonprofits are increasingly working in collaboration with one another to better serve their communities. Last year, 57% of North Carolina nonprofits said they partnered with other nonprofits on programs and services. In many cases, larger nonprofits like hospitals, private colleges and universities, YMCAs, United Ways, churches, and food banks are the hubs of these collaborative efforts. With the current strains on the nonprofit sector, the impact on North Carolina communities of policy changes that create new costs for nonprofits, such as new taxes or fees on nonprofits, or limitations to tax incentives, charitable giving is magnified. As charitable nonprofits rarely as charitable nonprofits rely more and more upon their collaborative partners to be able to maximize their ability to provide essential services, even policies that would reduce revenues for a small portion of the nonprofit sector can diminish the quality of life throughout the state. And finally, with our remaining minutes, we'll read from the Viewpoint page, The Publisher's Notebook, written by Brian Hamilton, publisher of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, End of a Journey, Start of an Exciting Chapter. It's not easy resigning from a job at a company you love. For the last 11 years, I've had the distinct privilege to say that I work for a media company that is embraced by so many thought leaders across the country. Triangle Business Journal employees have worked hard to earn that respect, and it's been clear from the very beginning that this company is fully dedicated to providing an uncompromising value that profits businesses. When I was tapped on the shoulder by company CEO Whit Shaw to lead the Raleigh team, I didn't feel ready. This powerful brand and its talented people felt so much bigger than me. The challenging job at hand, the opportunity of being a part of something great, and the supportive words of leadership inspired me to rise to the occasion, and what a run it's been. We're seeing unprecedented audience growth. We're producing more content than ever before. Through the parent company's guidance, our visuals are now lush, modern, and relevant. We now conduct close to 30 events each year that bring the best in business together to connect. In all, TBJ today has more touch points with the community than ever before. These are some of the reasons I now feel ready to write my next chapter. And although I lost the battle to convince my extended family to move here, the Triangle certainly has helped stir up my entrepreneurial bug. My wife and I spent a lot of time reflecting on such a bold move, and we prayed together for guidance. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for this episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.